Hey everyone, this is Ksenia Montan and welcome to another episode of People of Marketing podcast. I'm the founder and CEO of Planable, the collaboration tool for social media teams, and I launched this podcast to take a sneak peek into the lives of top marketers. Every week, we explore the story of their careers, the choices, mistakes, wins, and imperfections of their work life. Today, we're going to take a sneak peek into the life of Amelia Turode. She's the co-founder of the PhoneBreak Collective. She launched it as an antidote to large ad agency, and it's a new operating system for brands. It's a totally new approach. Amelia has spent 20 years in London and New York working for agencies such as Ogilvy Interactive, Mindshare, VCCP, Naked Communications, and TBWA. She began her career as one of the first WPP marketing fellows and has built a deep, deep expertise in technology. Amelia, thank you so much for joining me today on People of Marketing podcast.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be with you.
Awesome. The way I love to start this interview is just by going backwards, you know, taking a walk through your career and trying to connect the dots looking backwards. So, you know, my first question is, what would you say was your first interaction with marketing and what got you into marketing from the get-go?
So that's a lovely first question. It's a really smart one. I guess for me, the thing that I really love and I'm fascinated by are brands. And if I think back to what was it about brands that kind of just hooked me in? So a long time ago when I was at university in the last century when there were not things like mobile phones. At least poor students didn't have mobile phones. So I was at university in Cambridge. And at the time in Cambridge, there was one supermarket. So I used to spend a lot of time, like lots of students, in supermarkets queuing up with food, buying food. And I didn't have a phone to look at. So you kind of had to do something else while you were bored. And I invented this game in my head, which I called basket economics. Essentially looking at the baskets of the people in front of me and creating kind of stories or pen portraits about who they were and how old they were and where they went to on holiday and what their last, you know, what they watched on television and kind of building up these images of these people and their lives in my head. And actually, I guess the thing for me wasn't whether I was right or wrong. The thing that I found so amazing was that you could make these kind of shortcuts. You could create these kind of images based purely out of the brands that they were putting in a basket. And I was really, really fascinated by that. How was it that brands almost become a shortcut for personality, or you can use them as a way to try and understand people? And I think it was that, I mean, that would have been back in 94 or 95 that I realized that I just wanted to understand more about how brands worked.
That's amazing. I think what you were doing back then, as a game of not getting bored, was, you know, you're basically building personas, but with like a more detailed storytelling side of it, right?
Yeah, I probably was. And again, at the time, you know, I never had the language to think about personas. It was kind of just stories about people.
Right.
And who they were and what they did. And actually, I mean, I was really lucky. So I knew that I was kind of interested in brands and how they were built and what they meant. And then I was in my college library, and for some reason there was a copy of Campaign magazine lying around, and somebody must have just dropped it there because we didn't subscribe to it. And on the front page was Martin Sorrell, and he was talking about the fact that ad agencies needed to up their game because he said that bright young students were going to management consultants. So, you know, this is...
How many years ago?
Yeah. It's a long time ago. And he said, you know, we're losing bright talent to consultancies. And so I sat down and I wrote Martin a letter. And I said, you know, dear, I had no idea who he was. I just said, dear Martin, one of these bright people who's kind of contemplating, you know, maybe I'm going to work in a consultancy, but I've got this kind of itch to scratch around brands. Can I have a job, please? And to his eternal credit, because, you know, here I was kind of 19 with, you know, nothing really. I got a reply back by return of post. So within 24 hours, saying, "Dear Amelia, you know, thank you so much. Well, A, I'm impressed that you're in the library. B, I'm impressed that you found a copy of Campaign. But I'm not going to give you a job because actually you don't want to work at WPP because essentially we're accountants." But what he did say was that he was launching a scheme called a WPP fellowship. And he told me to apply and he said he'd keep an eye out for my application. And the year after I did that and he remembered me at interview.
This is such an incredible story. I can't believe he replied. That's just amazing he did it.
You know, I find it incredible. And anyone who's ever worked for Martin, you know, he's got an army of PAs who surround him.
Yeah.
That would have come from him. And, you know, he's notorious or famous for answering incredibly quickly to emails. And but, you know, what I found amazing was that most people in business would never have done that to a student. And actually, he did, to his eternal credit. So, you know, I'm really, that really gave me my way in.
Yeah. So you joined WPP Marketing Fellowship. What were the next steps? You know, how did you, you know, got propelled in your career? What was, you know, tell us a bit about your journey.
Well, the fellowship was and still is an amazing way into this kind of world of marketing and brands because it's essentially a kind of choose your own adventure scheme. So it's a 3-year long fellowship. And the only rule is that you can't repeat the same discipline twice. So 3 disciplines from within WPP. And if you wanted to, 3 different countries, which is kind of amazing. The idea you could go and work in a digital agency in China, followed up by a PR agency in New York and advertising in London. I mean, it's really an amazing scheme. So I did that for 3 years. I started out in London doing in an ad agency, JWT. And then I stayed in London for my second year. I was doing media at Mindshare. And this would have been back in 98. So then I started to specialize in digital when people didn't really, I mean, it was such a kind of early days of digital. And then I moved over to New York to go and work at Ogilvy Interactive.
Yeah. And tell us a bit about the Fundbreak Collective. It's interesting, you know, you've worked your entire life in the agency world. Now you're doing something that you call it, you know, an antidote to large ad agencies.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that. What's the controversy?
Okay. So, I mean, I guess I'm definitely not anti-agencies. What I am anti are lazy agencies. And anti are lazy, bloated, fat agencies that are living on their legacy. And there are lots of them. And I guess by that I mean that they kind of tweak around the edges or they'll give a producer a different name or, you know, wow, you know, they'll sit creatives next to planners and you go, you know, that's their solution to the 21st century. And I guess I had just come to the point in my career where as you start to move up, you get further away from the work and you get more involved in management and building teams. And I just realized that it just got to the point where structurally these big ad agencies are structured incorrectly. You know, they're kind of built for the 20th century. And it's all about layered and longer. You know, you create multiple layers, you make a project last longer and you earn more money. And actually what clients were looking for was something that was faster and flatter. And in fact, people I worked with, really good talent, didn't want to work in these big bureaucratic corporations. They wanted to work in a flat way, in a very, I guess, sprint-like way. And lots of people I saw, really good people, was kind of stepping out of the big structures, wanting to have more control and more freedom over the types of projects that they wanted to work on, the types of clients they wanted to work for and the kind of people they wanted to work with. And that was a real kind of wake-up moment for me, actually.
That's so interesting. From the way you were describing, you know, the desired structure of an agency now in the modern marketing world, or like the future structure of agencies, it seems like you're describing a startup to me. To me, that sounds very familiar, you know, being in the startup world. So is that the type of thing you're talking about, like flat hierarchies, agile, fast decisions?
You know, I think there are definitely elements of
similarities of
culture, and I think there definitely are. But I think for me, what it's most akin to, what it's most similar to, is what happens when teams work on a pitch. And actually, I love pitches, and what I love about them is a kind of a sense of urgency on a project. That you don't really have time for politics. You run fast at a problem. You know, you put down your hypotheses, you work towards them. And actually, maybe as I'm talking, you're making me think that actually it does sound a bit more startup-y. But I've always been amazed when you work on pitches, you definitely don't create perfection in a pitch. But, you know, you can get pretty far, pretty fast with a gang of focused people pointing in the same direction. And I guess I kind of wanted to think about, could you take the best bits of being in a pitch without the constant all-nighters and the tension? And actually, could you take the good bits and actually build it into a different way of working and a way of working that feels more sustainable? Because actually, non-stop pitching, and actually, I think non-stop startup, isn't necessarily very healthy, and I don't know how long you can sustain that level for.
Yeah, that's true. I think the way you describe pitches makes me think about hackathons. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the term. It's basically, you know, in the startup world, the hackathon is, you know, 48 hours or 3 days where you constantly, you know, focus mode work on something and you develop something from scratch. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it seems, you know, like that type of energy that you're describing in a pitch makes me think about hackathons.
So you're exactly right. So one of the products that we sell, in fact, it's probably the one that we do most of, is something that we call Strat Hacks.
Okay.
Strategy hackathons. I mean, it's essentially that. What we've tried to do is design a really fast process that thinks about strategy as a product. So how do you create a strategic prototype? So again, in the world of hackathons, you're creating a software prototype or a hardware, but you're creating something. But what we try to do is exactly right, exactly your thinking, which is the elements of a kind of a hack-like process, but to deliver strategy. So it could be positioning, it could be brand personality, it could be purpose. I mean, we've developed lots of different types of strat hacks that kind of play a central role in the form break process. So you're entirely right as to where we're kind of getting our inspiration for how we're trying to work.
Yeah. So something that I had in mind when you mentioned, you know, the big and complicated structures of large ad agencies was that, you know, my question is that just a product of the fact that they are big and, you know, you might start small with a startup like structure, very agile, but then just because of the fact that you grow, you're going to have to become complex. You know, like small startups growing up into big corporations, they get to have, you know, those complex structures. So is it scalable, I guess? Can you grow an agile structures like yours?
Well, I mean, that's the question. So we're now just over 2 years in, and actually the kind of, you know, the title of our sort of our comms plan for ourselves for this year is, you know, from startup to scale up.
Yeah. Wow.
But, you know, the question that we are working through this year, which is how does it get bigger?
And yeah.
start to get questions, then you start to answer questions like, how big do you want to be? How can you create that? So often when you're working fast on a project, so one of the things that we try and do is we kind of have a 70-30 rule on projects. So we sort of 70% of the team have worked together before. Not everyone will, but so 70% will have worked on a form break project before. And then 30% are always new form breakers, new people coming in. Because what we have found is when you're trying to do something quickly, you get further faster if you have the element of trust, and if you kind of know how each other works. You need to be able to build on that. But what you don't want to do is either fall into bad habits or just build the same teams over and over again. So right. Kind of that balance between trust and understanding the ways of working and shortcuts to get there, but also adding in that element of new. And actually, people who don't know each other can sometimes help stop you from making either bad decisions or kind of sometimes lazy decisions. If you know each other too well, sometimes you can get a bit lazy as a team.
Yeah. So the collective, how big is it? How many people are we talking about?
So we're coming up for 300.
Oh, wow.
and it's kind of funny because actually it's always the first question, which is how big is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, people want to put a number on it.
But it's so funny because actually, you know, we're starting to think, you know, so we're starting to wonder, you know, because you could go, actually, it's all about numbers, you know, so it's better to have 1,000 people. But then you go, well, is it better to have 1,000 people who are very disengaged, who are kind of just waiting for a sort of a bit of a project and it feels transactional? Yeah. Or are you better off with 100 people who are really committed to try and building a different way of working? And actually, sometimes size and the numbers can be a bit of almost a red herring, almost distracting you from kind of engagement levels, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can imagine what you're saying. And my question would be, how many of them are active? I guess that's one thing, you know, to like, 300 is okay, but how many of them have, you know, been involved in projects recently?
Absolutely. That's a really good question. I mean, we worked out last year that we probably worked with, we think it's about 120.
Yeah. Okay. That's a pretty good number.
Yeah, it is. I mean, of that, they are people. So we also do strat hacks for charities and not for profits. So we do those for free. So those are kind of nighttime strategy hacks. So we form breakers sign up and participate in those. And no, you know, we're not earning money. That's a not for profit element. So form breakers are involved in strat hacks. They are involved in sort of commercial consulting projects. They might be coming along to socials. They might be coming along to field trips when we're going out doing kind of excursions. And then one of our most popular things that we did last year was an event that we're going to be carrying on, which is called a slow. And actually we came up with this sort of concept of a slow when we were running between meetings and we were juggling. And actually Sarah, who's my co-founder and business partner, sort of said, you know, actually we talk so much about speed and we you know, hacking things and agility and that actually sometimes there are issues where we all need to sort of collectively take a deep breath.
Yeah.
Slow down. And there are some subjects which actually can't be sprinted at or hacked at. And
right, yeah.
So the first one we did in, I think it was at the end of November or maybe early December, which was actually all about mental health and the freelance world, independent working. Because it's not straightforward. You know, when you work for a big company, there are many things that are bureaucratic and annoying, but you do have a safety net. And, you know, you're working for yourself, you're an independent worker, you know, you're working without that kind of structure. You don't know what you're going to be earning month to month. You know, you don't know where the next project's coming from. You could have a really, really dry couple of months. And what happens to mortgages? It's not plain sailing. And actually, you know, there's no HR, there's no, who do you go and turn to for help? Kind of feels like these conversations are just starting to be had. So it was really important for us to, I guess, to be in that conversation and to try and connect people with organizations or other people that they could go and talk to, actually.
Right. So Fundbreakers, are they freelancers mostly, or do they do that on the side of like a full-time job?
So sort of registered Fundbreakers, I would say sort of 95% are all independent workers. They're all working independently. What we do have is we have a number of Fundbreakers who, I guess, normally we kind of call those sort of Fundbreak friends. Work for companies, but what they want to do, they want to come along to the charity Strat Hacks.
Okay.
They're really interested in the socials and kind of they're liking the kind of the community of bright entrepreneurial, I'm going to say kind, like you do have to be quite kind. It's not a collective of egos or kind of big swinging dicks. It's not like that. Quite flat. So actually the kind of people who choose to say, you know what, I'm really interested in being part of this, are quite thoughtful, quite kind people. And actually that is very refreshing.
That sounds amazing. But how can people apply, or do you only headhunt? Is there an application process, or how does it work?
I remember when we sort of launched and somebody sent an email going, is there a test? Is there a test? I was like, Sarah, is there a test? And like, I don't think so. Oh God, but what if they're terrible? And so I guess what we've kind of thought about is the collective is an open collective. You go on our website, the Fundbreak Collective, there's a survey. So we're kind of really interested in people's backgrounds and kind of how they view the world and brands and marketing. But we kind of, you know, we're also, I mean, we have a silly question at the end, which was, you know, tell us a joke that you always laugh at. And actually, we keep thinking that we're going to turn those into Christmas crackers at some point, but we haven't yet because we've been a bit busy. But what we have started to realize is that actually that the Strat Hacks, the charity ones, are a really good way of us kind of working with people that we haven't worked with before and kind of seeing how they react. You know, it's quite pressured. You know, you've got a charity with a really compelling brief. You've got 3 or 4 hours. It's nighttime. You've worked a full day. You know, you're working with people you've never worked with before. At the end of it, you've got to have a prototype of something. You know, it's quite stressful. But actually what we do find is that some people really thrive and kind of just really enjoy it. It's a bit like sometimes talk about CrossFit, or, you know, it's like a high impact exercise class. You get quite sweaty, but you kind of don't mind what you look like. You end up feeling it's quite fun. And actually, if you kind of enjoy Strat Hacks, you probably enjoy Fundbreak projects, because obviously they're not just one night.
Yeah.
But they are a bit sweaty, if that makes sense.
it totally does. So what I wanted to ask is, can you share a project, the Fundbreak project, that you really loved or you're really proud of, and one that you'd like to do over?
Yeah, of course. So they're all so different, and that's what I love, which is, I guess at our heart is kind of strategy and innovation. We can execute creatively, but the thing we just love is a kind of solving hard problems that people have got stuck on. So one of the projects that I think we really loved was for a big organization in London called Somerset House. And Somerset House is this amazing building. If you haven't been, you should really go. It's beautiful. It's an old 18th century building. In fact, it used to be a palace. Queen Elizabeth I used to live there in the Tudor times. It's got this wonderful history and it's incredibly beautiful. And it is now, it's starting a kind of new chapter. So it is a big arts and cultural institution. And the brief to us was a deceptively simple one, which is, what does John the Volunteer say when an American tourist walks into Somerset House and says, gee, what is this place? John the Volunteer, who's a real person, is a kind of Northern Irish, brilliant, kind of older volunteer and very straight talking. And what John the Volunteer can't say is, well, it's an ecosystem, it's a fusion. You need just something simple. And actually with Somerset House, it's really complicated. So it's this beautiful, huge building, very old. Partly they've got the largest number of working artists in the centre of London, almost 100 artists, sound artists, visual artists, computer graphics, these really young, modern, very rule-breaking, really interesting. So they've got these working artists. They have about 200 small businesses, all in the creative industries. They were about to open up a big co-working space for independent creatives called The Exchange. And they have galleries and exhibitions. They have a big courtyard, which is very famous, where they have ice skating in the winter and gigs and films. And it's really hard to explain quickly.
To define, yeah.
What is it? You know, is it an art center? Is it a gallery? Is it a courtyard with other bits? Is it a co-working space? What is it? And it's also interesting because you've got multiple stakeholders. So they also house the Courtauld Gallery and King's College London have a bit of it as well. And it's owned by the government. So, you've got multiple stakeholders. And in fact, what we did was we created a Fawn Break team, which were made up of artists and journalists. So we created the right team who understood the world and the outputs that Somerset House were developing. And we embedded in, I think, for about 8 to 10 weeks. And we kind of did this brilliant mapping project with all the artists and the small businesses. And we created multiple strat hacks with different people. And we were really trying to get to what was the essence of this incredible place. And actually what we came up with was a kind of a descriptor where we talked about London's Working Arts Centre. And actually a Working Arts Centre, and London's Working Arts Centre built on historic foundations. And then we talked about where new meets now, because everything they're doing is about really reinventing new thinking, new art, new possibilities. But the remit is about understanding the world we live in. But actually what John just fell in love with was, oh, it's London's Working Arts Centre. And this idea about working. Yeah. And when you go to Somerset House, you feel the work, you feel the atmosphere of creativity. It's not somewhere where you go to exhibit. It's somewhere where where people go to work. And we created a brand book and that turned into a film. And the film is now shown before every event. And we created new signage and we, even silly, it sounds silly things, but they really mean something. So Somerset House wants people, creatives, to kind of use it as a drop-in center. Pop in, drop in, do a bit of work. You don't have to buy a coffee. You can just come in and explore and sit. But their Wi-Fi, you had to log in and you got a two-hour slot. And actually one of the things we said to them is, you're talking about this place being a creative drop-in center.
Yeah.
People off the Wi-Fi. Well, actually now they've got a different Wi-Fi policy. And And actually, it's kind of changing the name of the lifts and changing the Wi-Fi, and a simple thing for a volunteer to say actually probably has a bigger difference than what's the end line or what's your corporate color, or, you know, because that's kind of experience, how you experience a brand and an organization.
Yeah.
That was a really fun and difficult project. But it ended up being something that's used every day. And by the people who work there, has been really embraced because we created this very flat collaborative process. So the trust, everybody from the organization was involved the whole way through. You know, we were given a room and we built our strategy on the walls, and the door was always open. We never closed the door, and everybody was always allowed in, and they could add up a post-it, they could add up a thought. So that actually the work that we gave them almost wasn't a surprise, but they were all involved in creating it.
It's such a beautiful project. You guys must be so proud of it, especially seeing it in real life implemented. I think that's amazing.
It was really great. It really was great. And in fact, that's then opened up a number of other projects with companies who are based at Somerset House who kind of participated in a strat hack, and then, you know, sort of pinged us an email or a tweet to say, hey, we're doing this thing, you know, could you come and help us on this project? And it's been really fun, actually.
Right. Tell me about a project that didn't go as lovely as this one, you know, a project that you'd like to do over.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably our first client, who I will always be incredibly fond of, who are a company called Hire Car. They're a car sharing, it's peer-to-peer, it's kind of like Airbnb for cars.
Yeah.
And we helped them to develop a positioning, and then we brought in designers, and they had a new logo and a kind of brand world, and they really, that was great. I think what didn't work well after that was that actually we really believe in brands, and, you know, a brand personality and a tone of voice and consistent visual language, and I think for some startups startups can almost see that as being a nice to have. And I guess our belief is that it's a need to have, because actually we don't see a difference between a brand and a business and a tone of voice and how you experience that. We don't see that as something that you tag on later when you kind of scale up.
Right.
But I think it can be quite hard for kind of smaller startups to think about that, actually. I think sometimes I think with startups, brand can be a bit of, maybe, I don't know if it's a dirty word, but it's certainly a problematic word.
I think the issue with brands for developing a brand for an early stage startup is the fact that you don't know it yet. You don't know what it's going to be. You're still iterating so much on the product, on the company, on your values. So it's not, there's no course. It's really hard to define it because so many things are still going to change. Maybe, you know, really core things are going to change. That's one problem. And then usually most startups are very tech heavy, and, you know, tech people are not as familiar with the brand world and not as, you know, as used with how important brands are.
I think you're right. I mean, it's a really good insight. In fact, we're just starting to do some work with Google Campus, which is the...
Yeah, wow.
Campus for startups. And we're kind of trialing a kind of something that we're calling brand in a box. Box is essentially a kind of really fast but sort of flexible enough brand structure for startups to kind of grow into it, but acknowledging exactly your point that actually you will pivot and you will start, but But equally, you know, what we're hearing back from these startups is, you know, when they're going into VCs and they're having these conversations, they're being asked questions about their brand.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting that balance between what's just enough and actually what's a brand structure and a framework to enable you to grow, as opposed to feeling helpful, as opposed to feeling like it's holding you back.
Right.
You know, that kind of, yeah, we're kind of interested in sort of brand in a box for those companies, because it feels like it could be quite a useful part of their story as they get bigger.
That makes total sense. So let's go a bit back to your career, to yourself, to Amelia, and more specifically to, you know, your early career. Do you have anyone that you admired, or do you have any like role models that supported you, or someone you followed and you know, helped you early in your career?
Yeah, I mean, I was very, very lucky at WPP. There was an amazing man who was 90 in December, and he still works for WPP, Jeremy Bullmore, who is extraordinary. And everything that Jeremy has written is worth reading. You know, it's absolutely, he's written, you know, books, he writes a lot of articles, but he is, I think, the smartest writer on brands and marketing. Just extraordinary. And I was very lucky that he was my sort of official mentor for my 3 years of the fellowship. And we have stayed friends ever since, which is, you know, I guess 25 years now. So Jeremy was a real kind of guiding force. The other person was somebody called John Steele, who has written some fantastic books on brands and marketing and how advertising works. Perfect Pitch, he wrote, Truth, Lies, and Advertising. And I think both John, who was a planner, and Jeremy, actually, who was a creative, really helped me think about, I suppose, about the importance of getting the question right. So you don't need to rush to an answer. A lot of times what you need to do is really spend the time and the discipline to make sure you're asking the right question at the beginning.
Yeah, I think it's extremely lucky to have mentors so early on, and especially mentors with whom you keep in touch for such a long time in your life. I think that's extremely, extremely, extremely lucky. What do you wish you knew when you were just starting out in your career? Like, if you would be able to give yourself some advice when you were just starting out?
I mean, I think I wished that I'd kind of worried a bit less, you know, and yeah. I guess I'd sort of worried a bit less, but actually the biggest thing now looking back is, if you're in a place where you're not happy, just get out. Because I remember somebody saying, well, you know, if you haven't stayed for 18 months, it's a black mark on your CV. And I'm like, you know what? That was probably some of the worst advice I've ever had. Because if you're somewhere and you're miserable, just get out. Like, just get out, because life is too short. And that was really stupid advice I was given.
Yeah.
And I really wish that I hadn't been given that, actually. I wish that somebody had just said to me when I was starting, you know, obviously, you know, there are always going to be ups and downs. You know, a job is like a relationship. You know, there are good days and bad days and good months. But if on balance you're miserable, like, yeah, life's too short. Get out and do something else. Find somewhere else to work, or go and, you know, go and build it yourself.
Yeah. Talking about worries and the challenges, that takes me to my next question of, what habits or skills did you really struggle the most to develop in yourself? And if you have any current ones that you're still trying to improve?
So I'm not massively organized. And I wish I was.
They say that about creatives, right? That's like the biggest stereotype.
I don't know. I mean, my parents were both writers. So we, you know, I grew up in this brilliant house that was so messy, and it was full of smart people, and we'd have brilliant arguments and discussions all the time over breakfast, and it was a house of words and discussion, and you know, just everything was like, it's not in my nature. I look at people who file things, and you know, their inboxes are white because there's no email boxes, and you know, I've got thousands of unread emails, and I try so hard, and I am so bad. I think what I've realized is I do really try, and I'm really dreadful. But my business partner, Sarah, is amazing. I mean, God, she like, everything is color coded and sorted. And actually, at some point in your career, you kind of go, you know what, I'm really good at this and I'm really bad at this. So why don't you find somebody to work with who's really good at what you're not good at? And why don't you create a little partnership?
Yeah.
And actually, thank God, because I'd be in prison. I'd be forgetting to pay my tax. And I'd be doing this podcast from a prison.
Self-awareness is the most beautiful thing in the world, from my own opinion. You know, knowing exactly where you are, where you stand, and figuring out how can you complete what you're missing out, you know, either by joining other people or by developing that. But I think, you know, having that self-awareness and being very open with yourself is crucial for the professional world.
I mean, it's my New Year's resolution every year, be more organized. I think it's been the same for like, I don't even know, 30 years.
I think that this one is about optimism. So you spent, you know, more than 20 years in this world of advertising and marketing and agencies. And after a certain experience, you might feel like you've heard it all. And obviously, yes, creativity is a muscle. You can develop it in yourself, and you also need to fuel it, and you need to take care of it. But today, what gets you inspired? Do you have any industries that you're following, or how do you get your inspiration back when you're feeling a bit down?
There's an American photographer called Walker Evans, who was a photographer in the 1930s in America. And he talked about kind of looking and eavesdropping and learning and constantly being open. And I guess I'm really fascinated by, you know, people and brands and culture and tech. And I think, you know, you've got to be kind of reading outside of business books, and you've got to be going to stuff that you wouldn't necessarily go to. And you've kind of got to let, not serendipity happen, because that doesn't make sense, but I guess just trying to get yourself out of your rut, out of your filter bubble. And actually, I think for the last sort of 6 months or the last year or so, I haven't been particularly good at it because I've been working too hard. And actually, one of my New Year's resolutions is to diary it. So kind of just to put time into the diary to go to see a film that I kind of think that I'm not going to be interested in, or to go to a talk or a lecture, or just because actually it's kind of those things that you think aren't directly applicable that open you up and kind of spark different thoughts. I've realized now that actually, unless you make time for it, it's quite easy for that to drop away.
Yeah. I think this is a really interesting insight and also very counterintuitive. You would guess that for inspiration, you have to look into the spaces that you're interested in to just, you know, go deeper into what you need to know more. But I think it's a very interesting point of view that you have, you know, with inspiration, getting out of your box. It's an interesting answer. Something that I wanted to ask you is, you know, what's like one belief or buzzword that is trending today, very popular in marketing today, that is annoying you, that you disagree with, or that you think is just hugely overrated?
You know what? I think performance marketing is utterly useless, because what it implies is that everything that isn't quote-unquote performance marketing is non-performance, that doesn't add to a performance. And I think it's a massively unhelpful phrase, because it's just wrong. It's a wrong phrase. Somebody somewhere has created a phrase that's wrong. people keep using it. So, you know, you go to companies, they go, well, you know, what are you going to put for performance marketing versus non, and it's like, it's really unhelpful. So I think performance marketing is a very useless phrase.
This is so funny. I've heard some other people, you know, having this beef with the industry, and I can't agree more. Okay, so wrapping up our interview, what I like to do is a rapid fire question. So I have three questions for you, because you already answered one. I usually have four, but you kind of told me, no worries, you told me about your worst advice ever. So that was included in my ideas of questions, but I have three others for you. So short answers, and you know, let's dive in. So my first one would be, you know, if you wouldn't be doing what you're doing today, what else would you do?
I think I'd quite like, in another life, if I'd had another life, I think I quite would have liked to have had a school. Because I think thinking about how people learn and how do you create a culture and confidence and expertise in the next generation, I think it would have been amazing to have kind of designed a school and to run a school.
This is such a great answer. It kind of relates to what you're doing at the Fun Break Collective. It's somehow similar. I don't know why, but it makes sense for what you're doing today. My second one is, do you have a favorite social media network?
I love Twitter. My heart belongs to Twitter.
Good. And then my last one is, what's your favorite app or tool that you use at work?
Can I be really lo-fi?
You can.
Post-it notes.
And oh, wow.
Post-it notes and big A3 pieces of paper.
Amazing.
Every sort of presentation, every talk is always mapped out. Post-it notes are the thing that my life would be much harder without.
This is a great answer. And Amelia, thank you so much for taking the time to share your story. It was really fun chatting with you. And I can't wait to launch this episode. I think it was really great. And
thank you so much.
Yeah. And for everyone else listening in, thank you for joining. And I hope you enjoyed this episode. And don't forget, we have new episodes every Wednesday. Subscribe to People of Marketing on your favorite podcast app. And till next time.